From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Earlier this fall, a Census Bureau report offered a spark of good news. U.S. median household income jumped more than 5% in 2015, the single biggest annual increase in almost 50 years. Also notable, the gains were largest for low and middle income households, a trend that was reflected here in the Granite State. This hour on The Exchange, we dig into these numbers on our monthly roundup of economic news. Later, we'll cover the impact of trade on New Hampshire. Also in Salem, a major employer is leaving town and taking hundreds of jobs with it. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests are Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Laura.
Also with us, Steve Norton, executive director of the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies. Steve, welcome.
Good morning.
And also with us, Russ Tebow, president of Applied Economic Research. And Russ, thanks for being here.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Well, before we dive into these three big topics that I just presented, Russ, to you first, just take a quick economic snapshot for us, please. Where we're at in the fall of 2016.
Well, I think the main thing I looked at since our last meeting is the job situation. Here in New Hampshire, we added 15,000 jobs year over year into August, which is a very good number, very healthy. It's typically averaged 12,000 in a good year. It's been running 6,000 or 7,000 jobs year over year. So 15,000 is saying there's still a lot of momentum left in New Hampshire economy. And we added 15,000 people into the labor force, pulling them out of the woodwork. So a very good job picture for New Hampshire since our last get-together. Nationally, it's kind of interesting. We added about 150,000 jobs, and depending on where you go on the internet, that was either a very good number or a mediocre number. But it does show a slowdown of momentum nationally, adding 150,000 jobs month to month. And maybe, I mean, we've had this recovery going on for a long time. Someone like me starts looking to get a peek ahead, lift up the page a little bit and see, are we seeing signs of a slowdown? GDP also, gross domestic product, big number, was also a little slow. So it kind of says things may be slowing down a little bit, but we got to wait and see.
Steve Norton, if you were to take a quick picture of the New Hampshire economy and put it on Facebook or Instagram, what would it look like?
I guess I'd say that there were two periods post the Great Recession. One was the 2010 to 2013, where we were creating jobs, but we were creating retail jobs. They called it the barista recovery. Since that time, 2013, 2015, during the period where we're seeing, you know, real income growth, you're seeing increases in the number of jobs that are, you know, over $60,000 a year.
So the so-called good jobs.
The good jobs, that's right. So you're starting, I think, you've seen a big increase, and that increase in jobs, while good, is even better because those jobs are actually, some of them are good jobs.
Yeah, I mean, that is a really good point that Steve's making, is that we have been generating these jobs that, you say, are better, or, you know, more substantial jobs, and that better actually for the economy as a whole when people have, you know, obviously making more money. And you do see that, especially in things like tech, manufacturing, where there's still been some growth in those sectors. You know, it's maybe not as strong as it used to be when we had, you know, digital equipment or one of these, you know, 5,000 employee companies. But it still seems to be a vibrancy in the tech sector in New Hampshire.
Well, and that gets us into the Census Bureau report. And let's talk about that, guys. Released a couple weeks ago, showing U.S. median household income surging, in the words of the Wall Street Journal, in 2015. Russ, how significant a surge?
Well, it's the biggest surge since they started collecting this data in 1967. So it is big. And the other thing that was interesting about it was very broad. And the people in the lower income categories who have been left out of this recovery to a great degree and are pretty upset about that actually showed an above average growth in income. So the other thing that's interesting about it that's a little bit obscure, maybe a little bit in the weeds, is this, that the incomes were up 5.2%. Average earnings were up only 1.5%. So how can this be? Well, the answer is people are working more hours. There are more workers per household. Maybe mom or dad didn't have a job. Now they do in this stronger. We've added 15 million jobs since the downturn. So a lot of the growth in income wasn't because of a growth in wages. It was because more people working longer hours.
Yeah, I was struck by that too, Steve, that the growth was about work and not about wages.
Yeah, and it's difficult to tease out in New Hampshire specifically whether that's the trend because, you know, if you look at the change in the number of jobs, the biggest change was still food services and drinking places. But ambulatory healthcare services added, you know, 3,200 jobs, average wage $71,000. So not a low wage. The third was social assistance, which was a low wage job. The fourth was computer systems design and related services, $110,000. So those are – that can really draw wages up when you start to see that type of experience. To Russ's point also, for the first time since the Great Recession, the median – worker is now making more money than they were prior to the recession. So that to his point that this now seems to be trending towards those lower wage jobs, the upward pressure of a tight labor market really impacting everybody.
Yeah, as people would say, finally it's affecting, you know, lower wage workers who have been waiting for that for many, many years. And you know, that's why there was so much pressure, it still is, on the minimum wage. And that's why the discussion there is on that, because those workers at the lowest ends have really been hit hard by this, by the recession and even by this recovery, which, as you know, Russ was saying, is not exactly the most robust thing we've ever seen. It's been pretty long term at this point, but it's not really – hasn't really had much of an effect until these latest numbers came out.
What about – oh, go ahead, Russ.
I was just going to say it's great to see these numbers, but I suspect if you went on Main Street here in Concord and asked people, are you doing better than you were last year? They say, well, not really, you know. I mean, so it's nice to see these good numbers, but I don't think it turns the tide of income inequality in the United States, job inequality. I just saw another report this week by the New Hampshire Employment Security that nearly one out of 12 New Hampshire workers has two jobs. And the reason probably is because you need two jobs.
So there's the income growth, but
that's right.
If you had better wages, you wouldn't need to work.
And it's
jobs.
A higher ratio than in the U.S., which is around 4%. So it's about 6.5% of New Hampshire workers have two jobs.
Oh, no, say that again, because that's interesting.
Okay. About 6.5% of New Hampshire workers have two jobs. They're multiple job holders. They might be in the food service industry or taking in the accommodation industry. That compares to around 4% nationally. So we have a much higher ratio of people holding two jobs. And that, I think, added to the fact that we have a very high labor force participation rate among women, explains the fact that we have, I think, the seventh highest median household income in the country. It's not so much that we make a lot more money. It's just that we work. We have a lot more workers.
And women working.
And particularly female, right.
And I just want to say that that's concurrent jobs. People are holding two jobs at the same time. It's not seasonal jobs where, you know, in the summer you're working at the ski area, at the you know, you're working building houses, and in the winter you're plowing driveways. That's not what we're talking about.
Right.
People actually have two jobs.
Right. A woman I'm friendly with works for a social service agency, and then she also bags at Hannaford's.
Yeah.
So there she is.
Well, I remember there was a political campaign, and one of the candidates, national candidates for president, was in Gilmanton and said, you know, well, the New Hampshire economy is doing great. You have a lot of jobs in New Hampshire. And the woman raised her hand and said, yeah, I know. I've got three of them.
I remember that. And that's you know, I'm surprised it's 6%. I would think really it's higher because I just know a lot of people myself who have multiple jobs.
That works out to, I think, about one out of 12, one out of something like that, one out of 13, I don't know, ratio. But it's a high ratio.
The exchange number for you to join us on our monthly economic news roundup is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. As we look at these Census Bureau numbers showing a big jump in median household income, are you feeling that in your own life? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Steve, what else is helping to boost this median household income besides the actual paycheck that people are bringing home? I mean, what else is helping their bottom line? Are we seeing, you know, lower inflation, for example, or I'm not sure.
Well, so in the healthcare world, you're seeing continuing demand for a broad array of services. That's one growth industry, if you will. The other growth industry is this tech world, And I think we have to be fairly cautious about how we describe this as manufacturing versus tech, because I think we're seeing a real evolution of the industry. And when we get to talking about exports later on, I think we'll discover that we're still seeing some fairly radical declines in sort of legacy manufacturing in New Hampshire. So I think we're benefiting from a very hot Massachusetts market that, you know, the prices of commercial real estate, the relative prices are changing. So we're starting to see some factors align which are pushing economic activity north again.
That helps us, having a hot real estate market in Massachusetts. People
hot
say,
estate,
you know, I'll just...
labor market is tight there as well. We have pockets of real entrepreneurial activity. Lebanon, Manchester, Portsmouth, all those areas are still growing for different reasons, but still growing.
Go ahead, Russ.
Another sector that's doing well this year that's nice to see is construction. We added, as I mentioned, 15,000 jobs in the state year over year in August. Normally, that would create – you need about 750 new housing units for every 1,000 in jobs that you add. We're way below that. We're only building 2,000 to 3,000 housing units a year. So what I'm thinking is that we – if interest rates stay where they are and the economy stays pretty strong, we're going to see a resurgence in housing construction activity, because right now vacancy rate in multifamily housing is under 2%.
Which is almost zero.
It's just kind of like they moved out yesterday, so we're vacant today, but someone's coming in tomorrow. You know, and then if you look at the ownership side of the housing market, we're down to about a 6 to 8 month inventory, which isn't very high either. So we're at the point where we're adding jobs, we're not building housing units, and I think we're going to see a resurgence in housing activity. I was talking to a planner yesterday talking about a 105 unit subdivision, single family subdivision in a small New Hampshire community. So we're at the point where housing finally is in its sweet spot. Jobs are in their sweet spot, and so we may see more activity. We need more activity in housing.
I want to say one of the things related to this housing, which I'm not going to say we're going to see a boom in it, but there will be an uptick in it, is that it's interesting in terms of the jobs part in the construction industry, especially in the construction trades, you know, plumbing, electricians, carpenters, all that stuff. There's a really dire labor shortage, and that's been driving up those incomes as well. There was a story just the other day about this construction trades program at Portsmouth High School that they're shutting down.
And several
of the contractors came and spoke and said, please don't do this. And one of the people who testified said the average age of a job site superintendent was 62.
Well,
so, you know, that, I mean, we're talking about some real concerns there.
And remember, Jeff, the last time we talked about this on the monthly economic roundup, last time or the time before, we got at least two calls from people who ran construction companies. Yes. One gentleman in Littleton, I remember, called and said he had great jobs, but he just could not get the skilled people to work for his construction company. Do you guys remember that?
No, exactly. Yeah. And I think that's the flip side of what happened in the late 80s and the 90s when we had this big building boom, because there were a lot of people here and they were taking those jobs.
Yeah, there was a time when they would say, if you know the right end of a hammer to hit the nail with, we've got a job for you.
Exactly.
Oh, okay. Well, I know the right end of it.
You got it going, Laura. Come on in.
The exchange number for you to join us on
our monthly
economic roundup, 1-800-892-6477. In this segment, we are focusing on a recent Census Bureau report that finds median household incomes in the U.S. had a big jump in 2015. We're wondering what you think of that. 1-800-892-6477. And Jane is calling in from Manchester. Hi, Jane, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
I recently spoke with our mayor, Mayor Gatsas, and he told me that 38% of the babies born in our city were born to single mothers recently this past year, which I found very disturbing to hear, having worked in a low-income pediatric clinic. And I'm just wondering if your panelists can comment about what kinds of jobs are being solicited on behalf of those mothers. They're not going to be IT workers. They're not going to be in well-appointed offices down in the mill yard, because we have the highest child care costs in the country, as far as I've read.
Sure, and need some flexibility, especially if you're a single parent, because there's only one person running around and getting things done. Go ahead, Russ.
Yeah, it's really a drag, obviously, for those single parent households, most of whom are female, but not all. I think that, as I recall, I looked at the poverty numbers for children in poverty. And it's the poverty rate of children in single-parent households is something like 20 or 23%, one out of five. So it's saying that this economy is not doing a good job in terms of providing opportunities for those single moms. So Jane makes a very good point.
Steve, you want to jump in?
I think we've never done a particularly good job of supporting a single woman with a child from a labor perspective. What's changed over time is a fairly significant increase in the number of women in single families. And I think there's a lot of debate now about, you know, how you support them through earned income tax credits or increasing the minimum wage or, you know, providing child support subsidies or other things. Fascinating report that came out recently from a very conservative think tank combined with the Brookings Institute, which is a relatively moderate left-leaning, trying to figure out how to deal with some of these questions about family structure versus wage supports and the like. So a complicated problem that, you know, people across the country are looking at.
Yeah, and that's something that's getting more attention here in New Hampshire, right,
it
Steve?
Is.
The
that's
charitable
right.
foundation and other organizations are looking at supporting these kids who are living in, you know, difficult circumstances. Let's go to Nashua next. And Chris is on the air. Hi, Chris. Welcome.
Good morning, Laura, and esteemed economist guest.
esteemed economists, they like that.
I got a promotion.
Oh.
Well, they do specialize in the dismal science. I figured I'd list them off. They'll get that one.
Thank you.
So the question here is, what are we doing to feed, like, from a high school level into the professional studies, these industries, these professions that really need the workers? And I know you had a show on this previously, Laura, which I did call into. But, you know, I'm thinking, like, just yesterday you talked about how we don't have enough, like, mental health professionals who
right.
are obviously masters or higher. And it's like that across the board. I'm in tech, and I can tell you it's ridiculous what's going on there, as your guests will tell you. So, you know, even at the lower levels, what are we doing to take people from high school and you know, point them in a direction? Because I feel like, you know, the traditional model is just like, you know, we give them a high school degree, give them a pat on the back and say, good luck with that. And I feel like they need more direction.
And maybe it's starting earlier, Chris. You know, usually people talk about higher ed, but you're talking right out of high school.
High school or even junior high, like, you know, what are we doing to equip them with the skills they need to really prosper in high school so that they can be pointed in any number of directions. You
okay.
know.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. Steve, go ahead.
I would say, you know, from a public policy perspective, we're seeing an unprecedented collaboration of business, education, higher ed, to deal with this pathway issue, which is, how do you create the next generation of workforce? And, you know, to give you an example, I know Fidelity supports some programs that in middle schools, which are designed to help young girls look at tech as a potential job in middle school. High schools have, you know, STEM programs that are designed to help facilitate, you know, the conversion to, you know, coding jobs and the like. There are incredible emerging relationships between businesses, high schools, and the community college system to create a labor force that will help them in, you know, 5 years, 6 years. So there's a lot going on across the state. High schools, community colleges, businesses really trying to build a pipeline.
Although Jeff mentioned earlier in Portsmouth, they're closing that.
I think that's the anomaly, not the norm.
Well, okay.
But to that point, there is less of a – in terms of tech and manufacturing, there is this really strong growing of relationship. But in terms of the construction industry, as far as I know, it is not that kind of a relationship. And that's why there's less of a concern in you know, about kids getting the message about these jobs in manufacturing.
Or social services. We did a whole hour yesterday on a severe shortage of mental health workers. After a break, we will finish up with this topic and we'll turn to global trade and its impact on the Granite State. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our monthly New Hampshire Economic News Roundup. And there's three big economic stories that we're looking at today. One, a Census Bureau report showing median household income in the country has gone way up from 2014 to 2015, with the Granite State seeing some of those same trends. We'll finish that up in just a moment. And global trade is the next topic. We'll look at that, the impacts on the New Hampshire economy, how some companies that export are not the companies you might expect. A little bit later, we'll talk about a major employer in the town of Salem moving out of town and taking 600 jobs with it.
Chime in on those stories if you'd like. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review, Steve Norton, executive director of the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies, and Russ Tebow, president of Applied Economic Research. And gentlemen, let's go right back to our listeners. And Celia's joining us from Brookfield. Hi, Celia. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I was wondering, I heard talk from the Democratic presidential candidates, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, about an increase in the federal minimum wage. And I wondered if Hillary does get into the office, if that goes into play, will that affect New Hampshire? Will we get, for instance, a $15 increase in the minimum wage, or is that not likely?
Okay, and Celia, thank you for the call. I think Hillary Clinton is talking about $12, not $15, even though there is this campaign called Fight for $15. Go ahead, Russ.
Yeah, well, New Hampshire's tied to the federal minimum wage.
$7.25
an hour. Our neighboring states of Maine and Vermont, both and Massachusetts, have higher minimum wages. So I don't think it would, you know, raising the minimum wage in New Hampshire would necessarily have a major negative impact. My bias, and this is something that is – this is a thought that is heavily influenced by your bias. And but I think in those states that have raised the minimum wage, there hasn't been an extreme dislocation of jobs.
Well,
and New Hampshire's is lower than our abutting states. I personally favor an increase in it. I think it would – stimulate spending in the state in retail trade. But the people in the accommodation industry, the people in the retail industry are all nervous about it.
Yeah, well, Jeff? They are. But we've done stories on this in the Business Review that in the southern tier, there is some kind of a pressure now for employees who especially, you know, who might go to Massachusetts where it's what's going to be $12 an hour as opposed to New Hampshire $7.25. There is some kind of pressure there. I mean, obviously, if you live in Nashua and you can get a job in, you know, Tingsboro, you know.
It's not that far.
Exactly. You know, why not go for the $12 an hour?
One other quick thing. There aren't that many people in New Hampshire that work at minimum wage levels. So it's not as if it would affect a quarter or a third. It's I think, under 5%.
Sure, but then if you raise the minimum, then you everybody else, you know.
Hopefully.
Also gets a push up.
The gap between $7.25 and $12 is what, $4.75, and you know we're talking
about a big jump.
And you're talking about people getting paid $9 or $10 in New Hampshire, but in Massachusetts, those wages might be going up even higher.
All right, Steve, go ahead, and then yeah,
just one. You know, we talk about raises in the minimum wage, and I think from a policy perspective, you need to talk about a whole set of other policies as well. You raise wages, the minimum wage, economists will say there will be some dislocation. There will be some workers, although everyone might be okay on average or better on average, there are going to be some workers that lose their job. And so in addition to thinking about the minimum wage, if you're moving down that path, you have to think about retraining and other job opportunities for people as well.
All right. Well, see, it's a great question, and we'll set it aside just for now, but we are planning a whole program on this later, looking at all the pros and cons. Thank you, Celia, for calling. Let's go to Amherst next. Lisa's on the air. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I was calling to comment on something that was said a few minutes ago about how the there's more tech opportunities in the middle school and high school for the kids to get engaged in. My son happens to be very handy. And I would argue the lack of vo-tech opportunities and traditional mechanics, the home construction, carpentry, electrical, plumbing, that give no matter if your hot water tank is leaking or your car breaks down on a deserted road, I would argue you'd probably pay as much as a brain surgeon in that particular to get your situation resolved. And yet to find these opportunities for training is very, very difficult.
That's, you know, when you need a plumber, you really need a plumber. Go ahead, Jeff and Steve.
It's interesting because I had a conversation the other day with someone who was when I was growing up, they called them shop teachers. What do they call them? They have a fancier name now. But
Tech ed, I think they call it. Yeah.
And you know, that was where you learned the skills like learning what the right side of a hammer is.
Right.
But now they have 3D printers in those classes. So they're learning the technical side of it. They're learning the technology. But as Lisa was saying, there's some other skills that you need to use with your hands. And also you could argue that there's a large number of students in New Hampshire schools, as well as everywhere in the United States, who do have that ability, who do have the ability to work with their hands, could be mechanics, carpenters, you know, any kind of thing like that, and they're not exactly being the – they're not the focus of these STEM programs. They're not the focus of the STEAM programs. That they're being – you could say they're being left behind.
And it's super important. I mean, everybody needs a mechanic. Absolutely. Everybody needs a plumber. Yeah, go ahead, Steve.
And we historically oversteer the boat. So in the 1970s, everyone said the end of manufacturing, so they shut down Voc Tech. And now we're at the risk of shutting down the hands-on schooling that occurs, HVAC people. Construction workers and the like. So the focus on STEM is really important and good, but we have to make sure that there's a balance. And Joe Marone at Albany International said this great. He said, I'm all for having, you know, important STEM workers, but I need a good HR person. I need someone who knows how to fix a door. I need all of that broad set of array to have a functioning company.
Yeah. I know of an anecdote. A lawyer needed a plumber on the weekend. He called him up. He said, how much is it going to cost me? My toilet's leaking. And the plumber said, $250. My rate's $250 an hour. And the lawyer said, I don't make $250 an hour. And the plumber said, I didn't either when I was a lawyer.
Oh. Wow. Well, Lisa, congratulations to your son for having those skills. It's wonderful. And let's take one more call, gentlemen, and then I do want to turn to trade and its impact here in New Hampshire because it's been such a hot topic on the campaign trail. Deb is joining us from Lee. Hi, Deb. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. I'm calling because it's nice to hear that there's this increase in median incomes and increase in the number of well-paying jobs. So are they taking it into the context of the increasing student loan debt and the cost of college education? Because in all honesty, I pay $1,300 a month for my student loan.
Wow.
And, you know, and when you pay that kind of money on your student loan debt servicing, and this is for 20 years, then the value of that higher-paying job is less.
$1,300, Deb. Go ahead.
Yeah, and my actual money that I have for living expenses is actually less now as a professional than it was when I had a bachelor's degree.
That's like renting two apartments, Deb, right?
Apartment and a half in New Hampshire. But.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you for calling in. And this came up, Russ, yesterday in our conversation about the mental health workforce, where the guest said, look, there are some young people who would like to get into this field, who are okay with not making a lawyer's salary or a plumber's salary, but they just can't make that calculation because of the student debt.
Yeah, and it's affecting the housing market as well. You know, so, I mean, one of the solutions that's being talked about is to reduce the interest rate on student debt. I know that when my wife graduated with student debt, this was eons ago in the 60s, she taught in a low-income schools and was 10% of her student debt was retired each year that she taught. First it was at Pease Air Force Base, which was considered low income, and then in a low income area in Manchester. So I think that we could, on a policy sense, for those sectors of the economy where we really, really need people, this would be one way to provide an incentive for people to get into those sectors. Reduce a portion of your student debt for each year you work in this favored sector.
$1,300 is a lot.
It is
per
huge.
Month.
I was really surprised by
that
number.
Yeah, I'm dating myself. Mine was $110.22. And right. I remember because I had to write the check out every single month. Well, one more question on this real interesting Census Bureau report. And Steve, for you, the report says, and I'm quoting here, income gains were spread across nearly all age groups, household types, regions, racial, ethnic groups. One exception, incomes didn't rise for households living outside metro areas. What does this mean for the Granite State?
Well, they're defining metro areas very specifically to, you know, MSAs, which include things like Boston and southern New Hampshire and Portsmouth. And so anything outside of that would be considered non-metropolitan in their analysis. But when you look at how we think of ourselves, our more rural parts of the state, you think of them in terms of counties, Carroll, Cheshire, Belknap, Coos, still are in recession. Still have not recovered. And the only places we're seeing real growth in jobs and the number of employed residents are in Sullivan, Merrimack, Stratford, and Rockingham. Hillsborough is just starting to see that, particularly in the Manchester region. So for wide swaths of the geography of New Hampshire, the Main Street is not experiencing such a good outlook. There are only a few areas in the state that are. They tend to be focused around our more urban and dense areas.
So here we see this national report, again from the Census Bureau, reflecting exactly what you've talked about on this program a couple times, Steve, and that is sort of good news for cities and not so great for everybody else.
That's right. Yeah, unfortunately, and I think increasingly the question is going to be how do we need to change our strategy to reflect that long-term demographic and economic trend, both in terms of protecting or helping the rural areas of the state, but also encouraging and accelerating what's happening in New Hampshire cities.
Okay, so building on the good stuff, but helping the others out. Gentlemen, let's turn to trade, because I did want to talk about that a little bit with all three of you, because it's been such a big, big issue in the presidential campaign this year. And I'm curious about the impacts here on the Granite State. And Jeff, I want to turn to you first. What's the best way to just assess the impact of global trade on New Hampshire?
I think, first of all, I mean, it's become such a hot button issue, especially in the last couple of years, especially during this presidential campaign. There's in New Hampshire, like any other place, there's winners and losers in this whole trade story. And they're in New Hampshire. Going back to the 19th century, New Hampshire was a winner from international global trade. If you think about the Amiskeag mills, not all that cotton, the textile they were creating, was being sold just into American companies. It was being exported around the world.
So a century ago, global trade was really working for us.
Yeah. And then what happened was, as the economy changed, you know, the world economy changed, those jobs disappeared. First, they went down south. To you know, the southern mills, but then they moved overseas, and now we don't have those textile mills anymore. We don't have the shoe factories anymore. And the same has been true lately. New Hampshire has a very, very strong exporting sector. It employs about 20,000 jobs are related to it. We've exported, I think, $4 billion worth of goods and services in 2015.
Okay, those sound like big numbers
for a small state. It's exactly. And it's become very dynamic, especially in the last 20 years. There's been much more of an effort to encourage small businesses and medium-sized businesses in New Hampshire to export. And I think that many of them have been doing it, because a lot of the exports are from small and medium-sized businesses. But on the other hand, we have seen the effect of international trade. There's been jobs that are just removed over in places like Somersworth and other places where they've been shipped over, you know, moved to Mexico, and actually jobs, you know, a lot of companies have just got shut down manufacturing operations in the United States and moved them to China or wherever. So what we see is that New Hampshire some people in New Hampshire have really been hurt very badly. They've lost their jobs, their livelihoods, and now that among those people working the two jobs at fast food restaurants or whatever, I don't mean to demean that, but you know, they're looking for work other places. But then there are other people who have gotten these jobs at these other companies that are doing really pretty well.
Can we say, this is probably too simplistic, but I'll throw it at you anyway, I mean, can we say on balance global trade is good or bad for New Hampshire?
I think on balance it is good for New Hampshire. In a way, because what it is that the companies that have that are benefiting from this are companies like tech companies and others that are the advanced guard of the growth of our economy. Those are the really good jobs, and the jobs that have much better effect economically, the impact economically on the economy. So it is, but it's not. That's just like general statement, because there are, you know, individual stories are. You know, people who've lost their jobs to international trade, to foreign trade, you know, you have to have sympathy for these people.
Sure. Who cares overall if it's
exactly
helping? It's
exactly.
Not helping me.
No, exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Go ahead, Russ.
Well, I think it is helping virtually everybody, except those who actually lost a job. And there are many of them in New Hampshire. The Economic Policy Institute, which is a labor-funded, maybe a little bit left-leaning group, estimated that New Hampshire lost 22,000 jobs to China. Between 2010 and 2013, and that was the third highest ratio of manufacturing jobs lost among the 50 states. So we have been impacted. Things like digital computer that isn't here, Cabletron that isn't here, Apollo computer that isn't here are all examples of the job losses.
Did those losses go to China or other foreign countries, though, or did they just go to, you know, Massachusetts or Texas or North Carolina?
The Economic Policy Institute study was just China.
Okay.
So if their numbers are right, then the job losses were even more if you take into account Mexico, Canada, and whatnot. And I'm reminded of a cartoon that was in the New Yorker where a woman standing there saying, yes, I would love to buy this new washing machine, but my husband just lost his job in the washing machine factory. Mm. So, you know, I mean, it's kind of – but the big benefit of it is that the price of things we buy is much less than it would be without trade. The price of television sets, the price of clothing, the ability to eat strawberries in the winter – raspberries in the winter. This is all because of international trade. And the world that we're in now, if we were to just chop off international trade, it would have an adverse impact on the state's economy. But going back to Jeff's point, it comes down to there are losers, and we're not doing a very good job of softening the blow, of providing a safety net for those people who lose their jobs due to international trade.
Well, the New York Times looked at this recently. You know, trade is under attack in much of the world because economists failed to anticipate the accompanying joblessness. And as you said, Russ, governments failed to help. Steve, you've been looking at trade in New Hampshire. What did you find?
Well, two things. One, you know, since 1995, our exports have gone up 160%. So from $1.5 billion to $4 billion, it peaked at $4.5 billion in 2013, and then we had a reduction, and it's come back up a little bit. But what's happening is we're seeing a fundamental shift in what we're exporting. The big losers in New Hampshire in terms of exports were industrial machinery, including computers, almost $200 million lower in exports in 2015 than in 2010.
Is part of that due to the higher value of the dollar?
Well, so it could be that, but it also could be just changing labor force decisions made by, you know, firms. You think about Dell, Micron, all those folks that were making computers, they've shifted huge swaths of their workforce elsewhere. Second biggest reduction, electrical machinery. These are things that are legacy manufacturing in New Hampshire, and we're seeing very big declines. We're seeing some increases. Arms and ammunition, and I'm not sure exactly what that is, but I suspect it's related to Sturm, Ruger and some of the other arms manufacturing firms. Aircraft, spacecraft, what's happening on the seacoast, I think we're seeing fairly large increases. But we're in the midst of change, and that's what the numbers suggest in New Hampshire. The industry mix is changing. And exactly.
So we export guns and aircraft parts, and then there's some smaller categories there, Steve. Food products, wood products, sort of made in New Hampshire stuff.
That's correct. Yep.
Yeah. Interesting. Jeff?
I just wanted to say, though, that in those numbers, the decline in the numbers also can be reflected by what's become, as we know, was a really serious and still serious global recession. You know, China was not in a recession, but China's growth has slowed dramatically. The EU is is an economic mess for the most part, and those are some of our biggest partners in trade.
Not for New Hampshire. Biggest partners for New Hampshire are Canada and Mexico.
No, I understand, but still, it's been the demand for these products it has been lessened because of that the global recession.
Yep.
Did you want to jump in real quick, Russ?
Yeah, just the big numbers that I picked up on. The United States trade deficit is almost $500 billion a year. The next closest is the United Kingdom. It's only a quarter of that. So we have a huge trade deficit relative to all the rest of the world. And we always talk about China, and they have a trade surplus of $300 billion.
Well, in the UK, that's a tiny country compared to the United States.
I know, but they're second, but they're way behind us.
I see what you're saying. All right. Well, coming up, 600 jobs leave Salem. We'll find out more. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our monthly New Hampshire Economic News Roundup, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We've been talking about the impact of global trade on the Granite State, and we'll finish up that conversation in just a moment, and then turn to a major story out of southern New Hampshire. A major employer in Salem is leaving town and taking 600 jobs with it. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And gentlemen, just finishing up the trade conversation that we were having, Jeff, Gene Shaheen and Governor Hassan just last week announced federal money for a Department of Resources and Economic Development grant to boost small business exports. And you mentioned small businesses before. In their release, they said, quote, Granite State's small businesses are creating cutting-edge products that are in demand around the world, and exports represent tremendous potential for growth. Steve Norton talked earlier about the kinds of products that are being exported successfully. What about that tremendous potential for growth, though?
I guess in some ways that's political rhetoric, but in some other ways there's a demand for New Hampshire made tech products. I can think of companies that are involved in things like it's companies in a little bit of a problem now, but GT Advanced Technologies makes these solar furnaces. They make, which is obviously a very, very big growth area. It's maybe not so much in the United States, but around the world. Like when they were going really well, they had huge customers in China, where because China is very interested in solar power. So the New Hampshire companies are creating things that are demand. I don't know about the huge. I actually, the tremendous part. Yeah, well, tremendous, because every time I hear words like that, after the last year or so of hearing these hyperbolic words, I have a reaction to it. But there is something to be said for New Hampshire companies that are much more aware of global markets and being able to sell their products overseas. I know when I first started here in the 1980s, there was very little understanding among small businesses. But there's been a great effort on the part of the federal government and the state to really engage smaller companies in New Hampshire in international trade, because I see that's really where the growth can be.
Well, on that word, tremendous, according to the Wall Street Journal, just this week, global finance ministers and central bankers are gathering in Washington this week, facing fears that an era of free trade and investment is ending, that the modern age of globalization is hitting a wall. So some concern there.
Yeah, there's some pushback there. I think, you know, the Kool-Aid, if you're an economist, drinking the Kool-Aid is trade is always good. Free trade is always good. But what's happened, I think, to change that, and there is sort of a shift occurring in the political arena about trade, certainly. Maybe not quite so much in the economic arena, because we are detached and have nothing to do with the real world. But on the political side, we are seeing it. And I think part of it is that the world's economy is not expanding as fast.
Yeah, and not just in America. In Europe, too, you see this.
Yeah, Europe, China's not growing as fast. Europe's not growing as fast. America's not growing. So since the pie is not expanding, we are all fighting over our slice of the pie, I think. And I think that's what's bringing trade and tariffs to the forefront, that the job losses we've experienced now are not as easily replaced with job growth. So they're
although
more painful.
Although we talked earlier, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, Russ, but we spent a long time talking about these great median household income numbers from the Census Bureau.
Oh, sure, yeah. But that you can have both at once. The water flows both ways.
Yeah.
So I do think that part of the pressure on trade and the push for tariffs politically is coming from the fact that the world's economy is not expanding as fast. America is maybe getting a smaller slice of the world, and that's bothersome to a lot of people.
Go ahead, Steve.
The economics literature still thinks that trade is good. What they misestimated was the dislocation costs.
Good for who? Right.
And that they overestimated the speed with which the labor force could change to reflect the new reality of the economic situation. And so that big pool of people that were dislocated by changing economy, changing skill requirements have not recovered.
And well, so, that's the question, yeah. Because so many times the four of us have talked about, you know, companies saying they don't have the skilled workers, whether it's construction or high tech. And I just wonder, Steve or Russ, you know, we hear jobs waiting. These are good jobs. But then you have displaced workers. So why can't the two mismatches come together?
They misunderstood the ability of the labor force to retrain itself. And that turned out to be more difficult for any number of reasons. There's an economist at MIT who's really doing some cutting-edge research on the set of systems and policies that we need to think about to support these types of transitions that are occurring now, whether it's community colleges or university systems or high schools. We've not done a good job of helping retrain.
Okay, go ahead, Russ, and then Jeff.
Yeah, I did work in Groveton. Groveton Paper Mill closed, lost a lot of good high-paying jobs, a small, very isolated community.
Very isolated. I've been there.
Yeah. Yes, and most of the people that lost their jobs were in their 50s. So do you take a 50 or 55-year-old paper mill worker and turn them into a systems analyst? There are limits to the flexibility of the labor force to adapt. Part of it is policies. We don't necessarily put enough resources into the retraining. But part of it is the specifics of the jobs, of the labor force that's losing their jobs, and the mismatch between those people, might be age, might be education, and what the good-paying jobs in the economy needs. If you're 55 years old, 60 years old, you've worked in a paper mill all your life, it's very unlikely you're going to step into a high-tech systems analyst job, with no matter what training opportunities are there.
Jeff?
Yeah, I was going to say, to Russ's point, it's not just growth, and that's the whole thing. We're seeing this in the North Country being played out. We have seen it in the last 20 years with the demise of the paper industry, which is a lot of it is because of the international, foreign competition, foreign markets, foreign producers. And it's not just Groveton, which is just one single plant, but Berlin, which had at one point had thousands and thousands of paper industry jobs, good-paying jobs, and Gorham as well. And that's affected the whole North Country. And, you know, where are those people going to go? It's not like they can go down the block and get a job, as you said. It could become a systems analyst, they're not going to find it there. They have to move. They have to move. And as Russ is saying, not only do they have to move, they have to all of a sudden learn new skills that in many cases is foreign to them, just as a foreign thing. And I think that's really what a lot of the frustration is that you see in what's going on in the political world right now, is that these are people who just feel left out and in some cases abandoned, because that's really – as to what Steve's saying, that's really what has happened by this. We haven't really thought of the full effects of what happens when you go into a full-on world trade system.
The exchange number for you to join our monthly economic news roundup is 1-800-892-6477. Let's get your thoughts, questions, comments about some of these economic headlines we've been covering. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. One more story, gentlemen, that I really want to follow up with you guys on. Speaking of jobs, a major employer, Jeff, I'm going to turn to you first, is leaving the town of Salem, taking with it 600 jobs. Now, that's a lot of people's lives severely disrupted. What company is leaving and why?
Well, it's J.P. Morgan Chase, which is one of the world's biggest banks. And I have to be honest with you, even though I've been at the New Hampshire Business Review for many years, I didn't even know that J.P. Morgan Chase had employed 600 people in Salem. I'm sure people in Salem actually know that. They certainly know it now. And J.P. Morgan Chase says they're moving them, not offshore, they're moving to other parts of the country, because apparently for efficiency or whatever, and they're offering some of these people chances to get the jobs, you know, move somewhere else. But as we're talking about, this is going to have a major effect on Salem. And the thing that stands out to me the most is, in terms of location, you can't get any better than Salem, New Hampshire, in terms of proximity to Boston. And to see that something like this is happening is something of a warning sign, I think, for some other possible concerns we might see over the next several years. This is the financial industry, which has been a very strong sector in New Hampshire. In Salem itself, just looking at that isolated individually as an individual's example, you know, what is that? There's 17,000 jobs
A little over 20,000.
20,000 jobs in Salem, and that's 600 of them. That's a pretty good chunk.
Well, it's a lot of families, and the company says it wants to, quote, better position workers in some of its strategic hubs, Dallas, Tampa, Tempe, Arizona, and Wilmington, Delaware. So not even a commute to Boston or Maine isn't even possible.
Yeah, the thing that occurs to me is I think the big picture. The mills, you mentioned the mills in Manchester, they lasted 100 years. They had a prosperity for around 1830 to 1930. Then the shoe and textile industry moved into those buildings, lasted maybe 50 years. And then the technology industry moved in, lasted 10 years. And so what we have now is a highly mobile, footloose economy where you can go where you want. You no longer are jobs anchored to where they are. The other story that we touched on very briefly the last month was EFI moving 300 jobs from Meredith to Londonderry. Yep. So it's a very dynamic job situation where firms are not wedded to a location, and they can move to wherever they want. It's more efficient.
But people are. I mean, if you live in Salem, New Hampshire, you might not want to live in Dallas, Texas, or Tempe, Arizona. It's very different.
Right. So you think about what the resources that now people are looking for. It's dense population of critical thinking people. And, you know, in a strange way, a loss, 600 people lose jobs. Maybe some of those will find jobs and fill some of the jobs that we can't fill now. So I think it's a complicated story. But I think the 30,000-foot perspective from my view is that any community that's not thinking about itself as creating human capital is not looking down the road at how they're going to be successful from an economic development perspective.
I really, Jeff, you made a very good point about this is a great – this is a hot spot in New Hampshire. Salem, right on the border. What, 30 minutes into – 15 minutes onto 495, maybe 30 minutes to Route 128. Yeah. And yet having this kind of disruption is disturbing to see. So,
although someone in the union leader was quoted as saying, with easy highway access, as you say, Russ, near exit 2, the space will be desirable once it opens up after J.P. Morgan Chase's departure. So some hope there.
Yeah, and I think people are commuting to those jobs. It's not all Salem people that work at this facility.
Well, sure. And that many of them are coming up from Massachusetts. I mean, it's right over the border.
In a sense, if you have to lose 600 jobs, southern New Hampshire may be a little less painful than, say, in Conway or because there are more opportunities relatively short distance away.
Well, and Russ, you have been involved somewhat in the planning for the former Rockingham Park racetrack, a big, empty piece of real estate, and big hopes now to make that area a new mixed-use downtown-type place, a project called Tuscan Village, a hotel, townhouses, apartments, movie theater, restaurants, shopping, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What does this job loss for Salem mean for Tuscan Village? Not necessarily, this particular loss, but more broadly, is it concerning for these developers?
In a nutshell, no. The drawing power of it will be about 1.2 million square feet of retail space. In other words, another mall at Rockingham Park in terms of size. And I did case studies in Dedham and Linfield, Massachusetts. The drawing power of these, they're called lifestyle centers. You can live, work, play, eat, dine, go to the movies, all within walking distance. Getting away from the old model of houses over here, industrial over that side of town, very auto-dependent. And there's a very strong appeal of these centers to millennials and to baby boomers both. And so I think that the loss of the 600 jobs is not a factor. The amount of retail activity that goes through these centers is just humongous, and they've been very successful.
Interesting. Do you want to jump on that, Jeff, too? I mean, is this concerning for you? You're building a whole new development, and then all of a sudden 600 jobs take off.
I would think that that's independent of what's going on because, this is really designed, this Tuscan Village thing is designed to attract people from elsewhere, not the people in Salem, but, they're talking about getting people from Boston coming up and over from the seacoast and other parts of New Hampshire and New England. And, you've seen these things elsewhere. I think the interesting thing is they're talking about this as being almost another downtown in Salem. And it made me think, well, how could you create a new downtown? But I'm thinking, well, I live in a town that has an old Main Street. Old Main Street is not where Main Street is, So downtowns move and they adapt. And it's possible that this thing could become almost like the downtown of Salem.
And the experience in Linfield was it really did. The people that live there love it. They love to be able to go to a restaurant, go to the movies.
Linfield used to be total suburbia.
Yeah. There was one commercial building in the whole town before this 500,000 square foot center opened. And it's called Market Street and very popular, very well liked.
All right. Well, I always like to close out the hour with you gentlemen asking what you'll be looking ahead at over the next month until we meet again, if I could put it that way. Steve Norton, what are you going to be looking at? What are some of the small numbers or big trends?
I'm mostly interested in how the economy is going to respond to the election. That's what I'm going to be watching over the next 6 weeks.
Go ahead.
Because, everyone's watching this race very closely internationally in the country, and I think confidence in what's going to happen could be increased or decreased by the next 4 weeks of the campaign.
You also did some work recently, and maybe we'll talk about this next time, Steve. New Hampshire now the second oldest state in the country. For a while, we were bumping around 4, 5, 6. Second oldest, that sounds serious.
Yep, has lots of implications for state budget activities, for economic activity in the state, labor force issues, touches almost everything.
Okay, what are you going to be looking at, Russ?
Jobs. We're seeing a little decline in the job growth momentum nationally for the last 2 months. And if that continues, it could be a harbinger of the slowdown that will come at some point.
You're raining on my parade, Russ.
I'm sorry.
We started out well.
Here, let me give you an umbrella, okay? Income's going up. So there's the umbrella. But I'm concerned about – I'm really trying to look forward to see, okay, we've had 7 or 8 years of an expanding economy. At some point, it's going to slow down and maybe tip. And so that's what I'm kind of watching is jobs as the leading indicator.
Okay, and we'll pick up on that maybe next time. Jeff, how about you? What are you going to be keeping track
of? Well, actually, I'm with Steve on this one. I'm really interested to see what happens, because especially with the markets, how they respond to
the financial markets.
Yeah, they have been actually occasionally responding to what's been going on in the presidential race. And also internationally, there has been a lot of concerns raised about protectionism, and which we didn't get into as much. But that's something that could really affect world markets.
Yeah, and getting back to your conversation about exports and New Hampshire jobs and so forth. All right, all of you, this has been great. Jeff Feingold, thank you so much.
Oh, it was great being here.
Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review. Russ Thibault, good to see you as always.
Thank you.
Russ Thibault, president of Applied Economic Research in Laconia. And Steve Norton, thank you so much.
Thanks, Laura.
Steve Norton, executive director at the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our intern is Liz Torrey. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.